morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. A Senate committee has heard heartbreaking evidence from mothers who say they were forced to give up their babies for adoption. The inquiry is examining whether the Commonwealth drafted legislation which the states and territories then used to compel unwed mothers to hand over their babies. Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane.
Judy McPherson wrote out her testimony.
If you bear with me, I've not done this before.
But she struggled to read it.
My daughter was born in Queen Victoria Maternity Hospital in Melbourne in November 1964. And I first met her in 1990.
Excuse me.
A friend continued for her.
I was given medication that had a profoundly sedative effect. I awoke at the moment of birth semi-conscious. I imagined my arms reaching to the door at the far left-hand corner of the room as the nurse and doctor ran towards that door. I don't wish to speak to this anymore as it's very distressing. This is the part of my birthing story that was rewritten by the issuing of a second birth certificate.
Judy McPherson's name was removed from her daughter's birth certificate. Sealed records made it difficult for her to track her. Christine Cole was 16 when her baby was taken from her at Sydney's Crown Street Women's Hospital. She's researched the history of forced adoptions in New South Wales for a PhD. She's given evidence that in the 50s, 60s and 70s, it was common practice that unwed mothers, often teenagers, were forced to hand over their babies. The committee's heard evidence that many of these women were drugged, and in some cases their signatures were forged on adoption papers.
The file was marked BFA, Baby for Adoption. That was marked by the social worker whilst the mother was pregnant and when she first was interviewed by the social worker. They assumed that an unwed, unsupported mother, her baby was going to be up for adoption many months prior to giving birth. That reflected an internal health department policy.
The Australian Institute of Family Studies is currently examining how many women and children were the victims of forced adoptions. The support group Origin says it can't accept a formal apology, as some mothers still don't know the truth, that they were unknowingly duped into a process known as rapid adoption. That was a practice where the parents of a recently stillborn child were given a substitute baby, often from an unwed mother, who was wrongly told her child had died during or soon after birth. Origin spokeswoman Lily Arthur.
We have been approached since this inquiry started by women who have actually investigated what they thought was their stillbirths and have found out that there was, in fact, adoptions taking place. Now, while ever there are women who do not know that they still have children out there, you can't apologise for these crimes that remain hidden.
The committee's considering whether the Commonwealth played a role in drafting the legislation used by the states and territories to carry out these adoptions. It will also examine whether the Commonwealth should apologise, pay compensation, help with counselling costs, and whether it should establish one central office to help separated families to reconnect.
The Senate committee inquiry is due to complete its final report in late November. The inquiry chairwoman, Greens Senator Rachel Seward, is speaking here with our chief political correspondent, Sabra Lane.
It is a very emotionally charged inquiry. You really feel for the witnesses giving evidence. There's not an inquiry yet that I've been at or a hearing that I've been at for this inquiry that I haven't shed some tears. I think it's the same for other senators and certainly for the witnesses. For some witnesses, it's the first time they have told their story in public. They're very powerful stories, they're harrowing, and there's certainly ample evidence that these forced adoption practices were carried out in this country.
Some people are looking for an apology. Others say that they don't want that apology while there are still women who are under the impression that they gave birth to babies that were stillborn or who died shortly thereafter, and there's evidence that those children are still alive.
There's a group of women that very strongly support an apology, and they look to the apology that the West Australian government gave towards the end of last year and look at what a powerful response there has been to that. But there is also a group of women that are saying, no, it's not appropriate to have an apology now. There is a lot of unfinished business. They think there's illegal practices here that they want investigated, that there was mothers that were told their babies had died or were stillborn, and they've subsequently found out that, in fact, those babies lived and, in fact, will now be adults, and that they haven't been able to trace them yet, or, and more importantly, some mothers don't know. They were told that their baby had died or was was stillborn, and in fact they don't know whether that is in fact the truth. And it has been raised previously where there was evidence from a mother who'd been told the baby had died when in fact she subsequently found out that it was alive. We've also had evidence from mothers who said that the experience was so traumatic that they actually had blocked it out and they weren't aware that they had given birth, and they subsequently found out that they had. The depth of the despair and emotional impact this issue has had on these mothers is incalculable, and there is certainly issues that we need to address here.
For some women and some children, though, no amount of apology or money will ever be able to soothe their souls.
That's right. There's some people that I believe have been irreparably hurt, and it's had lifelong ramifications. That's not to say that, therefore, that we shouldn't be offering every, you know, as much support as we can, specialised counselling support, access to the medical services that are required, access to better record systems. There's some people have not even got a proper birth certificate, and they don't even know their proper name. Mothers have given evidence that when they went into some of these institutions where they gave birth, they were admitted under a false name, and that false name was put on the birth certificate. Imagine trying to find who you are tracing through that evidence chain. It's just non-existent.
Inquiry Chairwoman Green Senator Rachel Seward speaking there with our Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane. Lawyers for victims of sexual abuse say the Catholic Church has used a legal technicality to reduce compensation payouts to their clients. The Church argues its assets are held in a property trust that can't be held liable for historical cases of abuse. It leaves sexual abuse victims with no one to sue. Lawyers are calling on the Church to stop using what's known as the Ellis defence, and there are moves underway in New South Wales to have the defence overturned. Liz Hobday reports.
Lawyer Angela Cedrinus represents victims of historical sexual abuse. She says the Ellis defence has been a factor in about 50 of the cases she's been involved in.
It's certainly the case that the Church offers less money because of this defence. It is the case that it's more difficult to negotiate with them. I mean, a lawyer's ultimate weapon is to be able to say to your opponent, we'll see you in court, and that's just not an option in these cases.
The Church says in the Melbourne Archdiocese, at least, the defence has not led to reduced payouts. But another lawyer who specialises in abuse claims, Dr Vivian Waller, estimates there are hundreds of cases across Australia where victims have had to accept negotiated settlements because the defence means their cases will never make it to court.
The Ellis defence is morally bankrupt. I don't know of any other organisation that would say it's not possible to hold them to account for their actions on the basis that they're not really an entity, not a legal entity at all, and can't be sued. I find it quite extraordinary, and I find it morally bankrupt.
The Church says the Ellis ruling reflects the High Court's view, and while the Church must comply with its legal obligations, it's equally entitled to legal protection. The Church and its religious orders have long argued that there's no one victims can sue in cases of historical abuse. The perpetrators have often died, and those now in positions of power can't be held responsible. And the Church's assets, estimated to be worth billions of dollars, are held in various property trusts, which the courts have ruled aren't liable for the conduct of clergy members. The Ellis ruling is named for lawyer John Ellis, who finally cemented this defence when he tried to sue the Church for the abuse he suffered as a boy. He lost after taking his case to the High Court in 2007. John Ellis has represented many other victims in historical cases and says the defence established in his own case is frequently used.
It's always implied as to read between the lines. I've had lawyers for religious orders, you know, sit across the table from me and say that, well, there's absolutely no liability in this matter.
Dr Waller is calling on the Church and its religious orders to stop relying on the Ellis ruling.
It's about time that the different parts of the Catholic Church took some kind of moral responsibility for their actions and stopped hiding behind technical legal defences and stopped trying to pretend that they don't exist. I mean, nothing could be more ludicrous.
New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge introduced a bill to Parliament earlier this month to try to overturn the defence in that state. But he's worried the major parties won't back the bill.
Well, there is some concern that it won't get support because of the political influence the Catholic Church has here in New South Wales politics. But that being said, there are people of goodwill on this issue from all sides of politics.
Greens MP David Shoebridge ending that report by Liz Hobday. You're listening to AM around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 and a half minutes past seven. Internationally, we're on Radio Australia. And if you want to hear any of our stories and read the transcripts, go to our website. To find it, just type ABC AM into your search engine. Scientists have found the rate of carbon dioxide entering the world's plant life is occurring 25% faster than previously thought. The paper, published today, analyses 30 years of data collected from sites around the world. Scientists say better understanding of the way carbon dioxide is absorbed by plants will help develop more accurate climate change models. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
The process of photosynthesis is one of the most basic principles of science. But the accepted assumption on just how much CO2 plants are absorbing is now being challenged. Dr. Paul Fraser is the chief scientist with CSIRO's Marine and Atmospheric Research.
Well, up until now and for some time, we've assumed a certain rate of photosynthesis and respiration in a term we call gross primary productivity of the biosphere. This is the ability of the biosphere to absorb it in photosynthesis and to release it in respiration. Now, this new research, which is very exciting, but of course it's just the first paper on this subject, this is the first time we've seen what we think is a faster rate of this processing of carbon dioxide.
What have scientists actually found?
Oh, they found that this rate of processing of carbon dioxide by the biosphere is about 25% faster than we had assumed before.
The research is a collaborative effort between American, Dutch and Australian scientists. They've used 30 years of data collected from around the world, including oxygen samples from Tasmania.
We've known that these isotopes of oxygen that are present in carbon dioxide, we know that we've always thought they were probably telling us something about the nature of the carbon cycle, and now this piece of work, basically driven out of the United States, which collects data from all over the world, this type of data, the same sort of data we're collecting at Cape Grim in Tasmania, it collects it from all over the world and comes up with this synthesis that suggests that the gross primary productivity of the biosphere is significantly larger than what we thought.
Dr. Fraser says the work is an important step in more accurately understanding the carbon cycle.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the sink of carbon dioxide in the biosphere will be 25% larger or 25% smaller. It could easily be similar. We just don't quite know that, and that's where the new research has to come in to follow up on this important finding.
The research will help scientists measure and model the complete carbon cycle between the atmosphere, plants on land and in the ocean. The paper was published today in the Nature Journal.
Bronwyn Herbert, the reporter there. South African Nobel Peace Prize winner Archbishop Desmond Tutu has attacked what he calls a spineless approach by the South African government to Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. The Archbishop, who turns 80 next week, has invited the Dalai Lama, a fellow Nobel laureate, along to his birthday party. But South African authorities haven't issued him a visa, and time is running out. Africa correspondent Ginny Stein reports from Cape Town.
Happy birthday to you.
First, there was cake and celebration in honour of turning 80 next week. A massive cake in the shape of Australia, adorned not just with iconic images of kangaroos and koalas, but also of the Archbishop himself.
That's quite handsome.
Gorgeous.
Thank you so very much.
Australia's High Commission seizing the moment ahead of the Archbishop's birthday to thank him for serving as patron of its scholarship program. Next year, more than 300 South Africans will study for higher degrees in Australian institutions.
I've already said the nice things about your program.
But asked about the South African government's refusal to issue a visa to allow the Dalai Lama to attend his birthday celebrations, the Archbishop pulled no punches.
We should be pulled around by our noses by a country that is so viciously repressive of its own people.
South Africa's Deputy President Gatlima Motlanthe is currently on a four-day official visit to China. No announcement on the visa is expected before he returns to South Africa on Friday. The office of the Dalai Lama has now joined the Archbishop in accusing South Africa of dragging its feet over the issue. It says the Dalai Lama's visa application was first lodged in June.
You'd think, no, the person who has been invited is a terrorist. This is a Nobel Peace Laureate, one of the most respected human beings in the world. Anywhere he goes, he just draws huge crowds because of the person that he is and the message that he conveys. And as a South African, I'm just very sad that we could be so spineless.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu declared his retirement last year, but as his 80th birthday approaches, his commitment to freedom and human rights remains undiminished. This is Ginny Stein in Cape Town reporting for AM.
In the United States, a series of weak debate performances by the leading Republican presidential contender and Texas Governor Rick Perry have revived calls for someone else to enter the race. The focus is once again on the New Jersey governor, Chris Christie. Some Republicans believe he could be the politician that the Conservatives are looking for and need. North America correspondent Jane Cowan reports.
Chris Christie's name might have a ring to it, but the New Jersey governor's said it a million times.
I'm governor. I want to be governor. I'm not running for president. I simply do not have the desire to do it, nor do I think I'm ready.
But the Republican heavyweights continued to stoke speculation overnight with a speech at the Reagan Library in California, where members of the audience begged him to run.
Please, sir, your country needs you to run for president.
That heartfelt message you gave me is also not a reason for me to do it.
Part of Christie's appeal is his straight-talking style on full display during last month's hurricane emergency.
Get the hell off the beach.
The blunt warning inspired a dance track.
Get the hell off the beach. You're done. It's 4:30. You've maximized your tan and get out.
More than anything else, the clamour for a Christie bid reveals a deep and continuing dissatisfaction with the current Republican field. Just a few weeks ago, another governor, the Texan Rick Perry, was the favourite. Since then, though, he's alienated conservatives with some moderate stances, including on immigration.
If you say that we should not educate children who have come into our state for no other reason than they've been brought there, I don't think you have a heart.
Then there was the moment where he appeared to disassemble on stage during the most recent Republican debate.
Was before these social programs from the standpoint of he was far standing up for Roe versus Wade, before he was against Roe versus Wade.
Another Tea Party darling, Michelle Buckman, also appears to be self-destructing, recently giving credence to the long discredited fear that vaccination could cause mental retardation in children. Confounding observers further, it was the former Godfather's Pizza executive Herman Cain, widely regarded as a second-tier candidate, who won the Florida straw poll, which has always accurately predicted the eventual Republican nominee. In this kind of field, the former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney could end up the last man standing, another prospect that's entertaining comedians.
He's the perfect candidate in comparison to the other candidates. Next to Newt Gingrich, I have a normal human-sized head.
For her part, the former Republican vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, appears to be almost ready to rule herself officially out.
Is a campaign too shackling? Does that prohibit me from being out there out of a box?
There are real deadlines to consider. Several big states require candidates to file paperwork by the end of next month. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
To the financial markets now, and global stocks are back in the red as investors watch for signs of progress in Europe's efforts to stem the sovereign debt crisis there, markets are poised for their worst quarterly losses since 2008. In New York, the Dow Jones closed at 10,011 points. That's down 180 points. The Nasdaq was also down 55 points. In London, the FT100 finished the day down 76 points. The dollar is buying 97.7 US cents, having fallen 1.5 cents overnight. 74.8 Japanese yen. I'm Tony Eastley. That's AM for today.